Good afternoon. It is with honor and sadness that I welcome you to the Dr. William Bill Jenkins Memorial Special Session. In February 2019, we said goodbye to a public health giant who has impacted the epidemiology section, APHA, CDC, and the nation in an extraordinary way. Bill Jenkins was a guiding force in instilling the importance of learning and utilizing the tools of epidemiology and biostatistics to examine health disparities. But more than that, he inspired numerous students and colleagues to become change agents and do something about these health disparities and injustices. Who else do you know who could have been instrumental in getting a sitting president to acknowledge the injustices of the Tuskegee study? While we mourn this incredible loss, we will celebrate the life he lived, the contributions he made, and the legacy he has built to continue these efforts. We have many in the audience today who have benefited from the accomplishments of Dr. Bill Jenkins. At this time, I'm asking all of Bill's former students to please stand and remain standing. Would all of those who have participated or collaborated in any of the programs Bill started, please stand. Former or current members of SAFI, please stand. Those who were mentored by Bill, please stand. Those who work with Bill at CDC, please stand. Those who served with Bill in some capacity at APHA, please stand. And finally, those who loved Bill Jenkins, please stand. Look around you. As you can see, Bill's endeavors have reached many. All of us are thankful, and the nation is a better place because Dr. Bill Jenkins and his legacy, the legacy he has built. You may be seated. At this time, I want to Dr. Diane Raleigh to join me at the podium. Diane, this plaque is presented in memory of Dr. William Bill Jenkins in recognition of his lifetime commitment to epidemiology and in teaching so many to ask the right questions. Presented by the Epidemiology Section APHA on this fourth day of November 2019. Laurie Elam Evans, Chair, Tiffany Gary Webb, Chair-elect.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming today. My name is Diane Raleigh. I am...
You're a little bit shorter than I am.
Yeah, a little bit shorter. I was married to Bill Jenkins for 35 years. He was not only my husband, but my colleague in some work. I mean, he's a pain to work with. And he was my best friend. So I am really filled with happiness and sadness at the same time. And one of the things that Laurie and I talked about, and she did a great job of putting this together. Thank you, Laurie, for your dedication. The last project that Bill worked on was the book that Chandra and co-editors published on racism. I can't ever pronounce the title. Science and Tools for Public Health Professionals, hot off the presses, the APHA presses. And what we decided to do was, for this session, I'll give a brief talk about aspects of Bill's career, then Chandra will give you an overview of the content of the book, and Bill was the first author of the first chapter of the book on the, some of the historical background in looking at racism in public health. And I will give just snippets from that chapter. Now, I've been a presenter and moderator at APHA for a number of years, and I was always very careful about my timing, making sure I ended on time and kept everybody else to time. And I threw that out of the window today. So as a point of privilege, I'm just going to say what I have to say. It may take a little bit longer than 10 minutes for each talk. And then we're going to save questions until the end of the presentations, and it'll be sort of an open mic where you can comment on anything you might want to say around racism and public health or Bill's work or future work that people are focusing on. The other presenter is Chandra Ford. I left her. And I'm going to ask Chandra when she gets up to add anything to the introduction that I'm going to make about her. I'm reading this from the APHA website. Chandra is an assistant professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences in the School of Public Health at UCLA. Her research includes both conceptual and empirical contributions and targets the intersections of race, gender, and sexuality relative to health outcomes. Most of her research investigates the contribution of racial and other social inequities to HIV/AIDS disparities. Additional areas of expertise include critical race theory and health disparities among sexual minority populations. And as I said, she will come right after me when I after I talk about Bill's career, and then I'll end the session with a summary of parts of the chapter that Bill wrote. So let's get started. I know everything about this except how to start it. Okay. The following personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation existed during the past 12 months. I have no relationships to disclose. I'm going to read this so that I don't get emotionally involved in this, in the talk. William Carter Jenkins was born on July 1945 in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. He was delivered by Rosella Wilson, his grandmother, and also the local midwife. Fondly known as Billy, he grew up with two rich cultural heritages. In his youth, he resided in the Gullah Geechee community of his maternal family in Mount Pleasant, but also spent time in the rarefied old Charlestonian houses and businesses owned by the Jenkins family. In the 1940s and 50s, Bill's neighborhood in Mount Pleasant was an isolated Gullah fishing village off the coast of Charleston. The Gullah Geechee are a distinctive group of Black Americans from coastal South Carolina, Georgia, and northern Florida. They live in small farming and fishing communities along the Atlantic coastal and on the chain of sea islands which run parallel to the coast. Because of their geographical isolation and strong community life, the Gullah have been able to preserve more of their African cultural heritage than any other group. They speak a Creole language similar to what's heard in Sierra Leone, use African names, tell African folk tales, make African-style handcrafts, such as sweetgrass baskets. Bill's maternal grandfather fought for the Union Army during the Civil War and was mustered out to one of the Sea Islands in South Carolina. Bill was the great-nephew of Reverend Daniel Jenkins, a businessman, Baptist minister, and founder of the Jenkins Orphanage in 1891. At the end of the 19th century and during the first four decades of the 20th century, the Jenkins family owned several businesses and a local newspaper. In January 1892, Reverend Jenkins petitioned the city for the use of the abandoned Marine Hospital on Franklin Street and received permission to use it for his orphanage, and he received a small stipend. Bill always told the story about how at the turn of the century, when the children of the orphanage were caught up in a tuberculosis epidemic, the attending physician recommended that they play wind instruments as part of their treatment. After collecting used instruments and recruiting music teachers, the program eventually morphed into the Jenkins Orphanage Band. Ever the businessman, Reverend Jenkins dressed them in discarded Citadel uniforms and toured the band throughout the United States and England to raise money to support the orphanage. The band's downtown Charleston street performances showcased one of the boys conducting the band with the Geechee-style dance moves that eventually became known as the Charleston. Bill and his older brother were driven across what he described as a scary, rickety bridge from Mount Pleasant to Charleston to attend the Immaculate Conception School of Charleston. It was a Catholic school for African-American children, and Bill described it as an elitist place for mulatto families. But after scoring exceptionally high on the SAT when he took it at the end of his sophomore year and got offered a scholarship to Ohio State, his parents allowed him to return to Mount Pleasant and spend his last 2 years of high school at his beloved Lang High, where his mother and grandmother had graduated. Lang is a place steeped in Quaker tradition and Gullah heritage, and is the source of his initial exposure to Quakers, where he ultimately became a Quaker. In the fall of 1963, Bill enrolled as a freshman at Morehouse College in Atlanta. He adopted his now well-known name of Bill that he used for the rest of his life, and he was forced to take speech every Saturday for 2 years to eliminate his Gullah accent. He graduated with a degree in mathematics in 1967, received his master's in biostat from Georgetown University in 1974, a master's in public health from UNC at Chapel Hill in 1977, his PhD in epidemiology from UNC in 1983. He completed a postdoc in biostatistics at Harvard University in 1987 and received an honorary doctorate degree from the Medical University of South Carolina in 2011. When he graduated from UNC with his PhD, he was probably the fourth African American in the United States to have a PhD in epidemiology. Now, his classmate, Jerome Wilkinson, disputes that because Jerome was an epidemiologist at NIH for years and said that he finished first. But I like Bill's version. It's impossible for me to disentangle two aspects of his personality that drove his career. He was a scientist in love with epidemiology. One of his favorite memories that he talked about was when he discovered epidemiology as a graduate student in biostatistics. He said he would sit entranced in the epi course that took place after lunch and was taught by the most boring professor he'd ever had. So boring, all the other students would just cry thinking about going to class. Mm-hmm. But I probably heard him tell this story 1,000 times of how excited he used to be every time he went to that class. But he was also fiercely dedicated to social justice issues. That began when he was a teenager involved in voter registration in Charleston. And early in his stay at Morehouse, he was a foot soldier with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was jailed with John Lewis for demonstrating against segregation in front of a restaurant owned by Governor Lester Maddox. As a scientist, his approach to social justice used the scientific process. He applied that knowledge to looking for solutions to social dilemmas that influenced the health of populations. There was no separation between his intelligence as a biostatistician, who evolved into an epidemiologist, and his dedication to the social causes of his life. His eyes would twinkle when he recalled his discovery of epidemiology. And that same spark was there whenever he launched a new public health project or talked about his work or recruited students or did anything to promote a public health issue. Now I want to describe two areas of Bill's work that were lifetime activities for him. The first was his activities related to the Tuskegee syphilis study, for which he was well known. But the second, he would say, was probably his more important contribution to public health, which was expanding the public health workforce in epi and biostat, and later to include all of the public health disciplines. And his very special way he developed mentoring. Bill began his career as one of the young, He began his career as one of the youngest African Americans to join the U.S. Public Health Service Commission Corps in 1967. He first served as a statistician at the National Center for Health Statistics. This was within a year after he graduated from college. He was a biostatistician by day and, after hours, a radical activist. He really thought the revolution was coming. And that combination eventually led him to become the first equal opportunity employment officer for NCHS. And while part of what he did as employment officer was to insist that the agency develop a better upward mobility path for African American and other non-science workers stuck in low-wage jobs. He insisted to the point where he even went on a hunger strike until the agency acquiesced. You know, it was the 60s, they put it up with people's demands, and he was successful. It was during that time, and I think as a result of his insistence, that he first learned about the infamous Tuskegee study, because another NCHS colleague familiar with his tenacity and radical tactics handed him some publications and asked him to read them. It didn't give any commentary. He just said, I want you to think about these papers. The publications provided findings from a federal government study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, men who resided in Macon County, Alabama, with Tuskegee as the county seat. And this was probably around 1969. When he first saw these papers. As you may recall, in 1932, the Public Health Service began a study to record the natural history of syphilis among these men in hopes of justifying a treatment program for blacks. This was prior to penicillin. Although originally projected to last just 6 months, just to document evidence of the complications of syphilis, the study actually went on for 40 years. The researchers explored what unchecked syphilis would do to the human body. At the time, there was no precedent for an informal consent or informed consent process, and the men were not told ever that they had syphilis. The researchers made sure no subjects would seek care anywhere else but under their guidance, even when they moved to other places or entered the military. Bill was troubled by the ethics of the situation and spoke to his supervisor. Don't worry about it, his supervisor told him. Later, he found out that the supervisor was one of the scientists involved in documenting the study. But he went on to discuss the publications with other black colleagues with whom he ran an underground newspaper for black government workers, and they decided to write an article about the study for their newspaper. The group also sent copies of publications to other African-American doctors and to a few reporters, hoping to get people interested in thinking about the ethical issues related to the study. But they also did not include any background material or explanatory information or explain their concern about the study, and the news media did not pick up on the story. He was deeply disappointed that he could not get anyone to pay attention. Eventually, another public health service epidemiologist, Peter Buxton, gave the information to the Associated Press a few years later. The AP article appeared on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere and shocked the nation. The study was soon halted, and Bill was always very happy with Peter's success. In the summer of 1973, a class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of the study participants and their family. And what you can't see in the slide, I don't know why, the larger picture is a picture of one of the study participants and Fred Gray, the lawyer who filed the suit on behalf of the families of Tuskegee. A $10 million out-of-court settlement was reached. And as part of the settlement, the U.S. government promised to give lifetime medical benefits and burial services to all living participants. The Tuskegee Health Benefit Program was established to provide these services. Almost 30 years after attempting to stop the study, Bill was appointed the manager of this Tuskegee Participant Health Benefit Program at the CDC. He expanded the services to provide support to all of the descendants of the men. And in 1997, he told the Times, "What they deserve is the best medical care we can provide. I try to give them the care that I would want to give to my mother." And in doing so, he was able to do wraparound services that included social work, nurse visitations, anything and everything to make sure all the family members remained healthy and nutritiously cared for. So he finally got to serve the men enrolled in the Tuskegee study and their families, and then he took a step closer to his attempt to help families from 30 years previously. He and some other African-American colleagues at CDC informally discussed the need for CDC to officially apologize for the study. He organized an external group that included Fred Gray, their original lawyer who filed suit for men, and Vanessa Northington Gamble, a medical historian and ethicist who actually spoke earlier today, who had chaired a committee, outside committee, to pressure CDC for an apology. David Satcher was director of CDC at the time and an obvious sympathizer. And so he took the request to Washington to inform the White House that this was probably going to happen, and Satcher would apologize for this study on behalf of CDC, the originators of the study, and the keeper of the study. The White House decided that President Clinton would make the apology. So on there was quite an organized effort to get all of the remaining men and family members to the White House. And on May 16, 1997, President Clinton spoke these words to the men and their families. And I won't read it out verbatim, but essentially he acknowledged that the United States had done something deeply and morally wrong, and it was an outrage. As you see, he said, "No power on earth can give you back the lives lost, the pain suffered, the years of internal torment and anguish. What was done cannot be undone." In addition, the president announced that he would build a lasting memorial at Tuskegee by establishing a Center for Bioethics in Research and Healthcare, and in, among other things, providing postgraduate fellowships to train bioethicists, especially among African Americans and other minority groups. And those activities became part of what Bill managed at CDC along with the other staff. He felt the families were finally vindicated and their dignity was restored. Every year, the Tuskegee Participant Health Benefits Program participates with Tuskegee University in a celebration. Of the role that they made to change the conduct of human subjects. So, I urge you, and I forgot to mention, and later, several years later, he made a video, a documentary, the first one that interviewed descendants, the men and their descendants, and got their perspective on what it was like to live under the shadow of the study. And I think this is the right website for seeing that video. It was never approved by CDC for publication. Okay, let's move on. It's my opinion, as I said before, that if you ask Bill what his greatest contribution was, it would be to change the face of public health through workforce development. And he talked about both the Tuskegee study and his interest in workforce development in, as a plenary speaker at the APHA keynote address, actually, with his best friend Cornel West in Denver in 2010. He didn't go into detail at that talk, but he had a major impact on changing the workforce and public health. He established Project Imhotep, the Public Health Sciences Institute at Morehouse College. Both of those programs are pipelined for undergraduates to go into public health. He worked at the Morehouse School of Medicine for a year to establish a Master's of Public Health program, the first such program at a historically black institution. These programs have supported the development of over 400 public health professionals, not only in EPI and biostat, but in environmental health and health education. These activities evolved from a 1970 meeting he attended of the American Statistical Association in Canada. The meeting included a panel on the status of black Americans. However, there were no blacks on the panel, and the only four African Americans were present at the meeting, all of whom had recently graduated in biostatistics. I just want to call them out: Bill Jenkins, Art Jones, Ernest Attaw, and Nathaniel White. Mm-hmm. And all four of them made a pact to continue to do graduate work in biostatistics so that they could become scientists looking at African American health issues. He wrote about the anguish they felt when they realized there were less than 5 African Americans with PhDs in either epidemiology or biostatistics, and they all committed to advancing their education and recruiting people into the field. And this editorial that you're looking at was published in 1991 at the beginning of the origination of the Society for Analysis of African American Public Health Issues. Another organization that's, it's not part of APHA, but it's affiliate of APHA that meets the Saturday before APHA. And thanks to Sandy Hogan for a wonderful meeting on Saturday. After the development of the MPH program at Morehouse, and given his ever creative way of doing things, Bill created a cooperative agreement that established a consortium for other historically black colleges and universities to develop public health programs. The consortium funded the opportunity for these HBCUs to meet together and plan public health programs throughout the U.S. And that consortium continues to meet today at APHA. I've listed some of the Sorry about that. These are the schools that have developed masters in public health or other, and some doctoral programs as a result of support from the consortium that Bill organized and funded. If I skipped one, please forgive me, and if anybody is here from one of them that I skipped, please let me know. But I think there are at least 8 or 9 HBCUs now that have masters of public health as a result of Bill's tenacious work. He also taught many undergraduate students in the Atlanta University Center and in the summer programs, and he always insisted, usually on the first day, that they memorize the definition of epidemiology. And expected them to be always be on alert to tell him that epidemiology was the study of the distribution and determinants of health status and disease in populations. He loved mentoring. He latched on to students, or they latched on to him, and he never let them go.
True.
He expected huge things from them. Just ask Laurie Elam Evans or Carl V. Hill, both leaders in public health research. Laurie is at CDC, and of course you know she's president of the EPI section right now. And Carl is at the National Institute on Aging at NIH. You can also ask F. Du Bois Bowman, the current dean of the School of Public Health in Michigan, someone who sought Bill out when he was an undergraduate student at Morehouse. Or you can talk to Crystal James, who's sitting here in the audience. She's the current director and chair of the Department of Graduate Public Health at Tuskegee University. And there's so many more that he influenced. Once again, his eyes would twinkle when he walked around APHA greeting all these people. And if we were going to the same session at APHA, we'd have to at least leave at least 20 minutes ahead of time. Trying to get down the hallway was just a pain. As you know, every minute somebody had to stop and say hello to Bill. And most of the time we were still late. But he considered the development of the workforce to be social justice work. And he talked about it in that same keynote address that I referenced to a few minutes ago. This next slide is reproduced from the talk that he gave, in which he talked about the things that make real differences in public health, and about how the programs that he worked on focused on mentoring more than showing, demonstrating role models, that the emphasis was on experience rather than exposure, whatever that meant, and that it focused on long-term goals of really redefining public health and the workforce that it's, that serves it, and things that he thought would make a difference. Now, I know I'm already over my time, and I'm not going to have a chance to tell you anything about his work with AIDS, HIV, but he was one of the first people to realize, when he was a statistician in the Division of STDs at CDC, that there's a disproportionate impact of AIDS, HIV epidemic in the Black community, and his projections about the epidemic were first published in the first version of health issues in the Black community. He was behind the scenes of the first 1986 AIDS Minority Health Conference held in Washington, D.C. Although he didn't have a formal role in the committee, he really redirected a lot of the thinking about how to conduct the conference. And as a result of that, he became the first manager for the National Minority Organizations HIV Prevention Program. It was really the first time that CDC acquiesced that they had to provide direct funding to community organizations. Up until then, all the money for AIDS, HIV went to state health departments and was supposed to trickle down for health education in communities. I found this in one in an envelope on his the desk, and it was probably a poster that he found on one of his site visits at one of the community organizations. Bill and I retired from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the summer of 2017. He was adjunct professor of history and co-taught a class with Vic, his partner in crime of many years and best friend and colleague. And the course was entitled, what, Social Justice and Epidemiology?
Inequality.
Social Justice and Inequality, yeah. Now, I was the paid professor at UNC Chapel Hill in the Department of NCH, but Bill worked diligently with students from the Minority Health Caucus, and he was the one that they loved because of his charisma, and he was the one who got the gift when we left. Not that I'm jealous. I'm glad they loved him so much. We did some serious traveling after we retired. We went to Ghana as part of a Black Quaker organization and worshiped with our counterparts in Ghana. We went to the Dominican Republic. He was kicking and screaming because all we did was sit out on the beach. And we took a luxury train ride across Canada. We were settling into St. Helena Island, one of those sea islands off of the coast of South Carolina that still was steeped in Gullah Geechee history and tradition at the time of his death. But he was in love with the fact that he could return to what looked like his fishing village in the 1950s. I want to give a big thanks to Vic Schoenbach for all of the work that he's done to preserve Bill's legacy and for the work that they did together in places like American College of Epidemiology and other places to promote minority health. If you want to know anything about Bill, Vic has it recorded. And that's his website. Thank you. Oh, we're going to hold questions and comments until the end. Put up a picture. Okay. I'll use the picture that.
So we want to leave plenty of time for there to be open discussion. As Diane said, one of the last projects, if not the last project, that Dr. Bill Jenkins was working on at the time of his transition was this book, Racism, Science, and Tools for the Public Health Professional. And by that, I mean, he was the lead author in a chapter, and he wrote one of two forewords, but also he was invested in the project overall, and he saw this project, I believe, as part of his legacy. And he saw us, the editors, as having the responsibility to carry out his legacy and the work of many people who had been working on this beforehand. So I just want to honor Diane's request to share a little bit about this book that he was invested in at the last days of his life, and the last years, I guess. So I want to start by asking you all to do something you don't usually get asked to do in an EPI meeting, and that is to close your eyes, and I want to paint a picture for you. I want you to just sort of go with me. It's 2017, November, Donald J. Trump has just been elected or selected, however you want to think of it, into the role of President of the United States. The American Public Health Association has commissioned us to write a book about racism. We don't have much other guidance. And my co-editors and I decide, really at a last, kind of last minute thing, we have to get some guidance from the contributors. And because this thing with Donald Trump is probably going to pass pretty quickly, we need to get their writing in fast. And so we pulled, with the generous support of Rich Lampert at the APHA Press, pulled together a breakfast symposium within literally a couple of weeks to be held at APHA 2017 in a small room with just a few chairs around a small table. We didn't have most of the authors filled out for the book yet, and we didn't even know who was going to show up. But the people who trickled into that room included Dr. David Williams, Dr. Kamara Jones, Dr. Vic Schoenbach. There were a number of junior folks, only a handful, Kristen Black, Cowie Baumhofer, who somehow or another were still able to show up to this meeting. You can open your eyes now. The editors and I were sitting there, really there to try to get folks to take on this book with the seriousness with which we saw the project. But we were quickly put in our place by the senior folks who let us know, y'all didn't start this talk on racism. Y'all didn't start this fight on racism. And we're here to make sure you do it right. That was important to me because nowadays we use the term racism explicitly in the work that we do. But there were people who were fighting, and sometimes they couldn't use that word racism explicitly. And it's precisely because of the battles that they fought against racism directly that we are now able to say, I study racism. Or that we're able to participate in movements in the street that are directly addressing racism. And so it was important for us to respect and honor our elders and the work that had been done over time to connect this desire the desire that APHA had expressed to do a book on racism to the work that had been ongoing for generations in this area. We felt a tremendous sense of urgency. It's hard to picture this now, perhaps, but at that moment, my co-editors and I felt like, you know what, if we want people to, you know, read this stuff on racism, we're gonna have to get it out like ASAP because this moment's gonna pass real fast. We had no idea that 2 years later that this book would be more relevant today than it was in 2017. I want to share just a little bit about my relationship with Dr. Jenkins during the course of working on this project, and then just outline some general contents from the book. So it was always my vision from the very beginning that there be this core chapter that has this history of anti-racism struggle within the field of public health. And ironically enough, I had to fight pretty much the whole way to convince actually both Dr. Jenkins and Vic Schoenbach, Dr. Schoenbach, that this was in fact a relevant and important chapter and that it had a place in a book that was about the science and tools of racism. So much of the content throughout the course of writing the book, Bill Jenkins just had so much content, so much material that just on a practical matter how we put this into a chapter was just almost, you know, hard to even imagine. So we started having regular phone calls. The problem with that was during the phone calls, we could mention one random word or one random meeting, and he'd go off, oh yeah, that was back in such and such and such and such a year, and so and so was at the meeting, and da da da, and we'd be like, wait a minute, we got to get that down. So he was a living library in many respects, and he was able to retrieve those details and share them with us as if they were happening right now in the moment. And capturing, I won't say capturing, that's not really the word I mean, but including that sort of energy in the book was really important to me. For me, in terms of the last few days of his life were really hard for me because I felt like I was not living up to my own personal wish to make sure he saw this before he left us in that way. But I believe that we were able to get that last phone call in, I believe, to say that, look, we do have things in the final version for this chapter. And I do want to say that as much as he had a lot of content for the chapters, he always apologized and was very generous and kind in the process of doing the work. And everyone who's worked with teams knows that that is not always the case. So I appreciated that. So what kind of content do we have? I want to start by just sharing from the foreword that he wrote, because I think it helps to illuminate, it illuminates kind of the nature of our relationship in terms of the book. There are two forewords. The first one was written by Dr. Kamara Jones, who's in the room, and who was the president of APHA with the idea for this project, is my understanding. The other foreword, and that foreword provides a sense of APHA's view and Dr. Jones's view of why this is important. The other foreword is called The Long Trajectory. And it starts, well, let me just say this. The way that it starts is tamped down sufficiently from how Dr. Jenkins wanted it to start. Race is a figment of the imagination. Racism, on the other hand, is real. The problem in America is not that people look different from each other. The problem is that people are treated differently because of how they look. Racism is a pervasive force that produces differences in health and socioeconomic status. Yet, historically, the field has focused on race rather than on addressing racism. This has helped to reify the notion of race and obscure the underlying role of racism in producing the patterns of health inequities that persist in our society. So, as I recall, there were he had quite colorful words for the nature of racism in society and also for the ways in which racism continues to work within our field. So the content, the book is structured in essentially units. The first unit asks, is racism a public health issue? And there we lay out reasons why we believe, contributors, various authors lay out reasons why we believe it is a public health issue. One of the chapters there actually offers generously, I believe, an illustration of the ways in which racism operates even within the schools of public health that train our future public health professionals. That chapter by Dr. Ariambua and Uwelemore. And it's asking for those who are in positions of power to use that power to better, to learn from the experiences of faculty of color, and therefore model equity in our training for students. The next unit is on how does racism affect health? And so we structure that part in terms of focusing on the structural mechanisms, the interpersonal mechanisms, and then how do we talk about these mechanisms? And we draw on Kamara's actions and allegories. And we're really delighted that in this section, she not only reprint those actions and allegories, a number of them, but she offers her reflections on how her thinking has changed since the original publication. What do we do about racism? And that's the place that people want to go to quickly. The challenge for us is really how do we do that in an evidence-based way? And there are a number of examples, for instance, thinking about addressing racism in the healthcare system, the anti-racism models of the Greensboro Collective, trying to increase scientific literacy, working with white allies and white people to be more effective allies. Are there group-specific experiences? That's unit four. And here, what was important for us is not just thinking, hearing the term racism and thinking black people in the South and whites, but rather thinking about the ways in which racism affects the experiences of, for instance, Native Hawaiians, Asian Americans, and various racialized religious minorities. In the final unit, we just ask, where do we go from here as a field? There, Brian Smedley, who many of you know, offers some remarks to guide us. The book also includes a number of appendices that include instruments, measures, etc., so that community members and public health professionals working on the front lines can use these tools and use concrete tools in real practical ways. So that is the book in a nutshell. I mention it in part because we sold out of it yesterday. So you might not get to see that firsthand. But thank you for the opportunity to say something about this project, and I guess
So this final discussion is actually from the okay, we'll just go to preview presentation. This final discussion is from the chapter that was co-authored primarily by Bill and Vic, and they were kind enough to allow Chandra and me a little snippet of contribution. I want to make sure that you understand that there are no relationships to this, financial relationships or commercial interests relevant to this presentation. Sankofa, many of you know, is an Adinkra visual symbol. Learn from the past, build from the past, and there must be movement from the past. But as we move forward in March, I can't read this. Anyway, the idea is that we revisit the past to learn how to move forward into the future. And this is the long presentation. So that was sort of the idea of some of the thinking in what is presented in this chapter. It's an example of reaching back to the past to support movement into the future. And in writing this chapter, the author reported to have two goals: to help public health professionals see the current efforts as part of a long history, and to provide examples from the past that might be useful in moving forward. The chapter provides a snapshot of how public health has responded to racism. Public health advocates have known of and fought against the health implications of racism for decades, but it's only in the past couple of decades that the term racism has been used openly, even though the efforts to overcome the impact have been ongoing. This chapter focuses on African Americans. However, we hope these lessons can influence strategies that public health professionals can use to advance the rights of all ethnic communities to attain health equity. I obviously can't include the entire chapter in this presentation, and I only provide a broad sweep of some of the history. And I've decided to focus primarily on public health response to the civil rights movement and highlight the evolution of anti-racism work that began in the last decade of the 20th century. I encourage you to read the chapter to find more about the little-known history of groups like the Association of Black Cardiologists, the National Black Leadership on Cancer, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Public Health Black Minority Student Caucus. Each of these is an example of confronting racism in public health. But let's start with the Civil Rights Movement, which inspired initiatives to improve the health of the Black community and to reduce segregation in American medical institutions. For example, the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964 led to the genesis of the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which became the medical arm of the Civil Rights Movement. The Great Society was a set of domestic programs that grew out of the Civil Rights Movement, and they were directed by President Lyndon B. Johnson from 1964-65 in response to the movement. The main goal was the total elimination of poverty and racial injustice. I'm glad we got that over with. It was just wonderful that we did that. In addition to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Johnson pushed through the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, which was created to oversee a variety of community-based anti-poverty programs. H. Jack Geiger was one of the Medical Committee for Human Rights physicians who successfully worked to apply President Johnson's Great Society program to public health. Geiger and Count Gibson, then chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Tufts in Boston, obtained a $300,000 grant from the Office of Economic Opportunity to establish a community health center at the Columbia Point Public Housing Project in Boston and, quote, a Southern Rural Health Center. The original proposal did not specify the location for the second center in order to avoid the director of OEO, Sergeant Shriver, from having it reviewed from and rejected by the Southern Congressional delegation. The Dorchester Community Point Health Center, now known as the Geiger-Gibson Community Health Center, became the first operating community health center in the nation when it opened in 1965. Based on the South African model of community-oriented primary care, Dr. Geiger's vision sought to confront abject poverty and medical disenfranchisement. He believed a health center would not only provide much-needed medical relief and social services, but also a path toward community empowerment and direct citizen action. People would lift themselves up and their families out of poverty and bring their neighbors with them. With the prospect of OEO financial support, Geiger and Gibson searched for a location for a site in rural Mississippi. Their campaign required circumventing strenuous opposition from Mississippi political leaders and its white medical establishment, as well as diffusing suspicion within the Black community. John Wesley Hatch, an African-American activist, did much of the original outreach and scouting up in the Delta. Geiger had hired Hatch, a social worker and community organizer with the Boston Housing Authority, who had been appointed to the Tufts faculty to help develop the Columbia Point Health Center. Hatch arrived in the Mississippi Delta in the fall of 1965 and spent several months getting to know the community, including working in the cotton fields. Hatch affirmed the choice of Mount Bayou and developed critical lines of communication within the community. Shriver approved Mount Bayou, Mississippi site only after Geiger and a Tufts vice president engaged in a sit-in at OEO. In this way, Geiger and Hatch together established the Tufts Delta Health Center, the first federally funded community health center in a rural community. Examples of other community initiatives during this period included the 1969 unionization of black hospital workers in Charleston, South Carolina, the Black Panther Party's free health clinics, which was announced in 1968, and free breakfast program to improve the nutrition of black children, and then in 1970, the Howard University Mississippi Project, which made a valiant attempt but unsuccessful effort to develop a center in Marks, Mississippi. Although civil rights demonstrations embraced nonviolence, arrests and violent acts eventually led to violent responses in early 1963. Most of the disturbances from 63 to 64 took place in the South, but outbreaks also occurred in Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Philly, New York City, and three New Jersey communities. In 1965, the Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles erupted in a five-day riot, leading the police chief to request assistance from the National Guard. Turmoil continued during 1966 and 67. A series of riots occurs in major cities, leading President Johnson to create the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, headed by Ohio Governor Otto Kerner. The Kerner Commission report, issued in 68, identified white racism as a major cause of the riots and called for new jobs, new housing, integration in housing, law enforcement, and in occupations. The report did not mince words, as indicated in this quote. Discrimination and segregation have long permeated much of American life. They now threaten the future of every American. The report was penetrating in its analysis, prescient, probably mispronounced that, in its predictions, eloquently crafted and essentially ignored by President Johnson. An article in the Smithsonian Magazine summarized the outcome of its title. The 1968 Kerner Commission got it right, but nobody listened. On the national level, the specific needs of blacks were of little interest to most public health practitioners, and therefore largely not addressed in research. The available data, notwithstanding their limitations, were extremely troubling. For example, age-adjusted mortality rates in 1968 were 45% greater for non-white, all other males, than for white males, and 62% greater for non-white females than white females. Although the racial difference was somewhat lower for cancer, deaths from cardiovascular disease among women was 61% greater for non-whites than whites. Public health institutions did react to some of the turmoil. With funding from the U.S. Public Health Service and the Milbank Fund, the first nationwide conference on the health status of the Negro was held at Howard University, March of 1967, with about 200 participants from 20 states. The conference discussed the major health problems of American blacks and the widening black-white gap in morbidity and mortality. Key determinants were socioeconomic and environmental deficiencies, including the shortage of health care manpower, and especially the shortages of black skilled and trained health care personnel, as well as non-professional health aides. Urgent and wide-ranging programs were needed, including a revolution or conversion in the thinking of healthcare providers regarding race. At its 1968 annual meeting, the APHA committed to hiring a staff to work on discrimination and segregation in health matters. APHA also adopted a resolution endorsing the Kerner Commission's report, and resolutions on poverty, hunger, neighborhood health centers, and other relevant topics. Moreover, black members of APHA formed the Black Caucus of Health Workers, perhaps the first national organization focused on the public health of black Americans. Now, let's move on to the health disparities movement. Persistent efforts by statisticians at the National Center for Health Statistics to draw high-level attention to the substantial mortality and morbidity disadvantages among racial and ethnic populations finally came to fruition when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Margaret Heckler established a task force that in 1985 issued a multi-volume report of the Secretary's Task Force on Black and Minority Health, also known as the Heckler Report. The 10-volume massive data in the report showed that despite all efforts during the Civil Rights Movement, substantial differences in health status between blacks and whites continued to exist. The report also noted the dearth of data about minority groups other than blacks. The health disparities movement was initiated with the publication of this report. Well-founded fears that this report also would become just another historical artifact to be forgotten, and soon after its creation, were countered due to greater inclusion of blacks in universities, professional societies, and government. After the publication, a group of epidemiologists and biostatisticians at CDC, and I'd like to acknowledge them, Bill Jenkins, Helene Gale, David Allen, Walter Williams, Sonia Hutchins, Diane Raleigh, Rick Richards, Alula Hadgu, Cheryl Blackmore Prince, and others, with the support of the senior statistician in STDs, Gladys Reynolds, held a series of discussions about how to advance the health disparities field. We didn't have that name at the time, though. We pledged to pursue and publish research that would focus on race or racism in public health, and strategized how to marshal organizational support from multiple institutions for a focus on health disparities. One strategy was to write MMWR articles on topics from the Heckler Report. In 1985, the MMWR published two articles on minority health, maybe three. By 1987, the number had risen to 10 as a result of a special focus entitled Topics in Minority Health that Walter Williams in particular pushed to have published. In the meantime, Raynard Kington and Herbert Nickens promoted the need for a federal office of minority health to develop public health efforts to improve black and minority health. The Office of Minority Health was established in 1986, and Nickens became the first director. Throughout the 1990s, organizations developed policy statements, such as the American College of Epidemiology Statement of Principles, Epidemiology and Minority Populations. It was formally endorsed by 19 other professional organizations and academic departments. In addition, the ACE Minority Affairs Committee conducted three surveys on minorities and epidemiology. Policies and initiatives resulted in increased education and training for young professionals, funding for research and interventions and publications focused on health disparities. Furthermore, a two-pronged effort of increased research and policy initiatives resulted in a number of initiatives to identify problems and potential solutions. Policies from APHA, American College of Epidemiology, and other associations resulted in a number of interventions to improve health status of Black communities. These include, for example, the training of minority public health scientists, navigation programs, infant mortality reduction programs, hypertension reduction programs, efforts to reduce differences in cancer mortality, and other initiatives. The Department of Health and Human Services Healthy People Initiative incorporated the goals of reducing health disparities. In 2000, the Healthy People 2000 goals, which were set in 1990, sets group-specific targets for reduction in disease rates among minority populations. And separate targets were set for African Americans versus white. This was the first document that signaled that federal policy was to actively work to reduce these disparities. It filtered down actions into state and local health departments for work. Healthy People 2010, under the direction of Dr. David Satcher, who was Surgeon General at the time that in 2000 when these objectives were developed, included the goal of eliminating health disparities. Prior to the 1990s, much of the epidemiologic research in the U.S. was based only on the categories of age, sex, and race, with race often being used in health statistics as a surrogate for socioeconomic disadvantage. Few multivariate analyses distinguished effects of components of social class from the relative, joint, and independent effects of social-cultural identifiers, such as race or ethnicity. This resulted in an underdevelopment of knowledge about racial and ethnic minority populations that could help shape public policies and preventive interventions to reduce health disparities. Studies that examined the influence of both race and class on began to emerge in the early 1990s, and these are just examples that I pulled from various sources to give you a sense of what the writings were about. Okay, moving on to the evolution of anti-racism work in health. In the United States, anti-racism work in health has evolved for more than a century. During this time, substantial efforts have been made to identify social determinants of health disparities and to create initiatives designed from the perspective that health disparities are socially of a social origin. We believe the political will to invest in these initiatives is still lacking. In the first decade after the publication of the Heckler Report, with a few exceptions, health disparities research focused on documenting differences in health outcomes between populations of color and white Americans. Much of the research focused on traditional, dubious factors like race, rather than mutable factors such as access to resources and culturally acceptable approaches to care. Anti-racism intervention, policy, and research became the focus of many African-American public health practitioners and their allies. The need for a broader focus on health disparities began to shift in 1991 when a number of key historical conferences were organized in Atlanta, Georgia. The American College of Epidemiology devoted its 10th annual scientific conference to the topic Morbidity Mortality Gap. Is it race or racism? I think Bill came up with that title. An ad hoc committee on minority affairs created by ACE President Raymond Greenberg and chaired by Victor Schoenbach held its first meeting during the conference. The following Sunday, the American Public Health Association began its 119th meeting on public health and a national health program. That weekend at Spelman College, a group from the CDC had organized a workshop on closing the gap through community intervention to discuss health disparities and to identify the factors that were continuing to cause them. Bill Jenkins was the catalyst. The announcement and coordinated agenda of Afrocentric events that he had sent out earlier read, "We look forward to the largest gathering of African-American public health scientists in American history." The conference preceded the first business meeting of the Society for the Analysis of African-American Public Health Issues, SAFHI, which became a related organization of APHA. The proposed bylaws for SAFHI were amended and adopted, and SAFHI's first officers were elected. Bill Jenkins is president, Vicki Mays, vice president, Cheryl Blackmore Prince, treasurer for many, many years, Michelle Davis as secretary. Several standing committees were also created with members selected from among the 64 founding members. SAFHI took a two-pronged approach of encouraging African Americans and those who were concerned about racial disparities in health to become more involved in shaping policy by seeking leadership roles in public health associations, and by continuing to conduct research on the etiologic factors that caused health disparities. SAFHI annual meetings serve as an open forum to discuss the role of racism in public health. And just as a side note, I just want you guys to know that several APHA presidents evolved out of that SAFHI experience, including Kamara Jones, who's here today. But I can't tell you how many, at least five.
Right?
Shariki, Linda Murray.
Was Joseph Tubman?
Yeah, a lot. Yes, yeah, and for the executive board, too. That was just the president. There's also a major pipeline into the executive board. While the 1990s came a new era of research technology, from epidemiology, biostatistics, medical sociology, anthropology, and other social sciences, which led to a burgeoning body of research on the contributors to health disparities. Public health researchers began targeting racism explicitly in their conceptual and empirical publications. They began viewing racism through a public health lens, seeing it as an exposure. The work focused on how to conceptualize racism, develop the methods to study it rigorously, and to produce empirical evidence about its effects in health, in the health of populations. This approach contrasted with previous efforts based primarily on concepts like race and poverty as the cause of health disparities. Instead, the newer ideas examined racism, culture, and targeted interventions designed to improve health across all levels of socioeconomic status. This slide is a shameless acknowledgement of the group I organized and worked with at the CDC Division of Reproductive Health. Work on reproductive health and cardiovascular disparities demonstrated that the relationship between social determinants and health disparities is more complex than presumed and therefore requires new models of thinking. The etiologic factor is not race, but racism. It expanded to research to incorporate the social, cultural, and political context of life and the protective mechanisms available in communities, and it included African American women and their communities as collaborators in research in order to avoid some of the problems of scientific racism. Where do we go from here? The core of this chapter chronicled the complex slog of efforts by many researchers and practitioners working from the 19th century up to today to reverse the effects of racism on health disparities, especially those experienced among African Americans. We have seen how racism works on an institutional level via the limited access, if any, that African Americans had to medical centers of any kind, with segregation structures keeping blacks out of hospitals until the hospitals faced the potential of restrictions on federal funds, and with health clinics becoming available in the South only after visionary federal leaders skirted customs that called for the approval of white elected officers, white elected officials. But as these glaring and indeed outrageous causes of health disparities have ended, health disparities remain. Public health researchers have shown how these disparities arise from personally mediated and institutional obstacles in nearly all areas of life, not explicitly identified with health. And because health disparities arise from the combined impact of disadvantages and insults in so many areas of life, policy and institutional actions are not in themselves sufficient to eliminate the disparities. The review of progress, I thought I had a slide on this, let me see. Anyway, the review of progress of 2010 objectives found that among 169 objectives with data for race and ethnic groups, health disparities decreased for only 27 objectives and increased for 25, essentially a draw. Racism remains a fundamental challenge to public health, a challenge which we must continue to confront. But there's no simple solution to this pervasive, deeply rooted problem, so multiple avenues must be pursued. One requisite strategy that we've discussed already is to stop using race to define people. Almost all population groups in America now define themselves in terms of history, culture, and values, i.e. ethnicity. However, many African Americans today accept being defined by skin color, meaning defined by race. I'm struggling with what to do with the 2020 census because I'm gonna declare my race as human. The racial and ethnicity diversity of the U.S. population is increasing along with growth in both percentages of marriages between spouses of different ethnicities and of babies who are multiracial or multi-ethnic. These shifts are changing the facts on the ground of U.S. demography. By 2000, the size of the Latinx population matched that of the black population, and the size of the Asian American population had surpassed that of Native Americans, changes that will become even more marked by 2050. The first step for public health professionals is to prepare for the effects of these demographic shifts. The shifts will not necessarily weaken racism, but they will change its dynamic from one that in much of the 20th century, the national discourse had been regarded as primarily white versus black, to a more complex mosaic. Unless real progress can be made in improving the absolute and relative early life and educational preparation for lowest status groups, the very different socioeconomic profiles of various racial and ethnic groups may lead to a society which, roughly speaking, white and Asian Americans will constitute an upper class, and African Americans, American Indians, Latinx Americans, a lower class, with multiracial, multi-ethnic persons occupying an intermediate class. A second basic strategy is to deepen our understanding of the basis for which racism and generally of harmful social behavior. Competition between people and groups is a fundamental aspect of biology and society. But so is corporation, and broad-minded people realize that their own well-being is affected by the well-being of all. When white people experiencing economic deprivation and insecurity see other groups like blacks, Latinx, and immigrants as a threat, that's deplorable. but understandable. But do we understand why white people of means are also driven by racism? Do we understand what differentiates people who take account of others' well-being in pursuing their interests compared to people who are either unmindful or even malevolent? Malevolent? Okay, I'm getting it. And I think I'm going to move on to the basics. The third basic strategy is to seek ways to reduce exposure to racism, to increase people's resilience in the face of racism, and to dissipate the toxic stress and other negative consequences of personal experiences. The most useful approach have individual and environmental effects. The Quiet Time program provides an example. Many African American and other ethnic minority youth attend schools with high concentrations of poverty in high crime neighborhoods and other stigmata. Teachers must devote an inordinate amount of attention to behavioral problems. In response to these problems, over a decade ago, San Francisco Public Schools introduced the Quiet Time program, in which children, teachers, and staff practice transcendental meditation at the start and end of each school day. Extensive data collected from San Francisco suggests that the program has led to reductions in fighting and other disciplinary problems, improvements in attendance, and gains in academic performance. Randomized trials among teachers and administrators observed decreased burnout and emotional exhaustion, decreased psychological distress and anger, and increased emotional intelligence. Although TM is an individual behavior, collective practice of TM produces efforts on the group by reducing provocations, disruptions, hyperactivity, and promoting an environment that is more conducive to learning. There are numerous published studies suggesting mental health, cardiovascular, and other benefits from TM, including reduced social conflict in communities in which a stabilized fraction of a population practices TM, leads to improvements in health. We are not suggesting that practices such as TM can eliminate racism or its adverse health effects, but the experience to date suggests that programs like Quiet Time can make an important contribution. And Now I want to add to the content of the chapter by reminding this audience of the importance of policy changes that specifically address dismantling racism. These changes must occur at the federal and state levels as well as in health institutions. APHA needs to continue to generate federal policy proposals and model state-level proposals. My colleague Vijaya Hogan and I think that institutions need to develop formal equity planning processes and have the tools to evaluate their institutional progress toward achieving equity. With the maturity of the public health field, the growing diversity of the United States, and the increasing awareness of potentially effective efforts against health disparities, we're in a position to make strong progress in diminishing the power of racism on health status. Much of the effort of the past was on dismantling corrosive and oppressive institutions while building a more inclusive cadre of leadership that could devote their careers to reducing health disparities. This work brought with it more resources, graduate programs, funding, and professionals who specialize in public health and health disparity. The progress also means that now there can be an open recognition that racism has been and is the central culprit in health disparities. Now that we acknowledge the situation in public health literature, let us continue the work of eliminating the effects of racism on health, work that has been in action for years, although not always directly acknowledged as such. Thank you. So now the floor is open to questions and comments, and I really want to encourage all of you to speak your minds. Mm-hmm. Who wants to go first? Okay.
Your presentation reminded me that I was with Bill at Morehouse. And I was one of the people who were handing out the position paper on Tuskegee as part of the drum. I think it was called the drum.
Yes, yes. And, we couldn't find copies of it anywhere.
I have met Bill in 3 different years. And the first time I met him, really, he was more of a mau-mau than an epidemiologist. But he retained that spirit throughout his professional academic life. And then I met him again at CDC with you and Helene, and we had sort of that after-hours black group that got together.
Social Health Society.
Yeah, yes. This is a very beautiful man. I'm so glad that he impacted my life.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. I just want to say, hi, my name is Sandy Azardo, and I'm the current president of SAFI, Society for the Analysis of African American Public Health Issues. And this presentation for me was incredibly meaningful in that I think sometimes some of us newer SAFI folk don't really understand the full history and implications of SAFI. And I think that's one thing that we as an organization, I know some of our board members are in here, are really trying to do and work toward is having people to fully understand why SAFI was created, why we exist, and why we persist. And so this for me needs to be part of like an orientation to become a SAFI board member. And I don't say it lightly, I'm being really serious about it, because we have a lot of discussions about who we are, who we should be. And over the last few years, I think we have gone through a process of trying to kind of figure out and actually really fighting with who we are, for better or for worse. Mm. I think Saturday was a testament to what you all have created. And I think for me, again, I've never considered myself to be a researcher. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm just a girl who went to a PWI and saw all of the people at the HBCUs, and I wanted to be one of them. And SAFI was my way to be a cousin in that space. But again, you know, as president, moving forward, I just want to say that, you know, I think we need help. Mm-hmm. I think your book, when you said it sold out, my heart slumped, but I'm going to go find it. I was going to take it off. I was just going to take it off the table.
There's an electronic version you can download too.
What I want to say is policy is something that we have consistently talked about being really involved in, and we need help. Some of us are still very young in the profession. We don't really know or have the guidance. And I'm not asking for people to join the board, but I am asking for people to help advise and guide us. In the same way that Bill and Kamara helped guide the development of this book. And so whatever we can do to get back to that space of where we are being actionable about the work that we are doing, that's where I'm hoping that people will be willing to lean in and help us do that. My only regret is that I didn't get the opportunity to be directly mentored by Bill, but I think that in his passing, the greatest gift has been the opportunity to be mentored by those who were mentored by him. So I just want to say thank you. And thank you all who have reached out and been supportive of SAFI, who have adopted the PWI cousin. And now I feel like I'm a full-fledged HBCU graduate, but I'm sorry. But I just want to let you know that we are committed to getting back to the basics and the foundation of what SAFI is so that we can advance the work that is being done. So I just wanted to say thank you.
And I would like to follow up, Sandy, on what you're saying, because SAFI has, members of SAFI have written many APHA policies. I remember in 2000, there was the policy on racism as a root cause of ethnic disparities in health outcomes, and Sonia, so a group of us, and I sort of led that one, and Sonia Hutchins led another one in that same year. And so SAC has had a history of engaging in the APHA policy process, so I think that's a good thing. I also wanted to stand and say something. So Bill preceded me in so many ways, and even the day before he passed, I was able to call and thank him for that, and in many ways in APHA and the American College of Epidemiology. Like, he was a trailblazer. But I also want to say that none of us is fully formed. Like, so the bill that at the end and the presentation is the version that was the last version of Bill, you know. But there are many versions, and if he were still with us, and I think he's with us now, there would be an evolution. So I think that what we need to do is engage actively with each other in the area of ideas, because I remember many years arguing with Bill whether it was culture or racism. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that, not for any other reason except to say that that's true, right? And somebody might argue with me now for the next 10 years about is it racism or something else, you know, and like we're all moving together. So the opportunity of the EPI section right now, of SAFI, of the Black Caucus of Health Workers, is for us to engage in intellectual work, policy work, all of that, that we are here together. It's fun to listen to each other's presentations and they sound really polished. But the other thing is we can move agendas, we can move each other's ideas and understanding, and so we shouldn't sleep on that either, that we are amazing scientists and policy people, and we need to take advantage and rub against each other. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's a hand that's holding all these rocks together, and we can form each other into a strong hand, you know, as opposed to be like little rocks that hit together and then they go. Okay. I don't know, do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm going to go back over and decide.
I just walked in 5 minutes ago, and I'm sorry I didn't know about it until Zanae told us over the internet. I want to make sure two things were said about Bill in case they hadn't been said. One is he was a brother you could always count on. If you had signed up to do something, you were going to speak, you were going to do whatever, and you found that you had your grandmother was hurt and you needed to deal with her, or you broke your leg or something, you could call Bill, and Bill would step in and do a hell of a job. That's one thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that Bill was a friend of students.
Yes.
And I want to say to you, that, to both the students and those of us, I'm a 40-year member this year, those of us who are getting ready to time out, that we, what's really important that connects with your idea about the rocks, is we have got to work together. I felt yesterday for the first time in the policy hearings that we were on the edge of a revolution at APHA. Mm-hmm. When I first joined my section, I looked out and only 10% of us were people of color. I looked out today, 90% of us are people of color, mm-hmm. and 98% of us are in the leadership position. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying not to say what my section is, but it's not going to be known. Yeah. But what I'm saying to you is, this is the time in which you stand on the shoulders of your elders. Some of them are still here. And you have the innovation and the new ideas of how to step forward. This is an important moment for both of us. And Bill helped to create the ground upon which all this is happening.
Thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do I say this? Well, first, it's almost like I thank you for your presentations. It kind of reminds me of subcaption Bill Jenkins yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. For several reasons. As you mentioned, Sankofa, you have to look back to where you're going in order to know where you're going forward. I met Bill in the mid-90s when I went to school at Morrow School of Medicine to that MPH program. Now, ironically, I only stayed there a semester and I didn't necessarily have a good experience, but I had a terrific exchange with him. And subsequently, I transferred out and I still kept coming back to APHA and running into him and seeing him, and he welcomed me with open arms. to the fact when I ran and essentially got in active in APHA EPI to be one of the chairs, you know, I constantly would approach him to make sure, am I doing this right? You know, I know there's a lot behind, and, you know, and he always would provide that warm and assuring visage, you know, that advice. And, of course, as you mentioned, not only the work that he did with respect to his craft, but also that drive-hard spirit behind the scenes. And that's where I think it'll be helpful, not only to the established generation, public health professionals, but to the new generation, to recognize that there was that fire that, no matter what, still kept burning. And you may not be an epidemiologist, you may be in other fields, but I almost look at the other deeper symbol of Dinkabi, which, you know, don't hurt each other, support each other. Because ultimately, doing that, I think, will bring great credence to his honor, his name, and we should benefit from at least taking those steps to realize it's not just getting your degree and, you know, getting a nice job, et cetera, but you have to have that social and ethical commitment to establish and really do right by our generations, both behind us and to come.
Thank you. Is somebody else in the section? It's 2:45. Okay, it's 2:45. What time are we supposed to end?
2:30.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're ending, but you can have the last word.
I just wanted to say that I met Bill Jenkins in the SAFI of 2018. When it was in Atlanta.
2017.
So I met him there, and he's super sweet. But also, he went, so I'm from the University of Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And so our building was named the Public Health Building, Tom Perrin Hall. And so we had a town meeting where we had to discuss the change in it. And luckily, he went and blew everyone's mind to the point where our dean said, we're going to fix this at the end. And it's no longer Perrin Hall. It's no longer Perrin Hall. It is the Public Health Building. So I thought that I didn't think that they were going to change the name because there were so many things around it. He didn't talk for hours. He said 15 minutes, but it was so powerful. So I feel blessed that I was able to be there and to meet him in person and meet him exactly. And I'm blessed because I have great mentors that were mentored by Phil. And so as a new generation that you all talk about, and I appreciate that, how can we maintain that fire? Like, what advice would you give me in order for us not to be jaded with the acronyms and the you know, publishing and, you know, getting the tenures and all that stuff?
I had one response to that I think would represent Bill, because the last couple of years of his life, everybody he met who was on the track of becoming a public health professional, he only asked one question, which was, how do you plan to change the world? And if you keep that in mind, I think that will keep you on track. Thank you, everybody.
I'm so glad I got one. Thank you, Lord.
Thank you.